This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly spoke with us earlier today about several issues that he has been dealing with his colleagues on Capitol Hill, including the alarming rate of suicides in Indiana and across the country. I understand that you've got a bipartisan bill going that would deal with suicide hotlines and making some improvements in that. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, we were able to get it passed, and the president signed it. Orrin Hatch, my Republican friend from Utah, and I worked together to pass legislation that would allow the FCC to look at putting in place a three-digit suicide hotline number, much like a 911. And what this number would do is somebody could call it, and there'd be a person on the other end who could help talk them through a difficult situation, try to find them help. And so we've seen very large at-risk groups. You know, some of the most at-risk are teenagers and veterans as well. And so, you know, we'll be helping all parts of our communities, but in particular young people and veterans with this.
I know that the veterans hotline is a much longer number, and you have to go through sometimes couple different operators. Would this in turn make it a lot easier, not only for veterans themselves, but for the VA to be able to help deal with this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The whole idea, for instance, you know, is to punch in, say, 711, mm-hmm. and you're connected. That's it. Okay. And that's the whole premise behind this, is to make it simpler and easier to have someone to talk to and to try to provide help.
Speaking of the military, I know that you had an opportunity here last week to help lead 48 other senators along in urging that the Trump administration not abandon its duty to be able to protect service members and their families under the Military Lending Act. And we've had some very sad stories come out on NPR about the kind of impact that predatory lenders can have on military and their family members. Tell us more about the efforts that you're making on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, the efforts we're making are to do exactly what you talked about, which is to protect our service members. We had the Military Lending Act in place that helps protect service members, helps set maximum interest rates that can be charged to them. For instance, in a lot of our bases, if you go right off base, there are payday lenders and similar places located just across the street. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the protections that have been put in place continue. And the administration is actually looking at suspending the Military Lending Act, the parts of it that protect our service members, and we're fighting back to make sure we can keep those in place.
Now, finally, Senator Donnelly, we know that you had an opportunity, along with a few other senators, not many, but a few other, to talk recently with the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Tell us how things went in that discussion and how things stand on how you feel about his confirmation as a possible member of the Supreme Court.
Well, I've had a process in place, which is to review his decisions, to watch his speeches and read his articles that he's written, then to meet with him, which we just did, and then to watch, you know, and take away all the information from the Judiciary Committee hearings with Judge Kavanaugh. And so we're in the middle of that process right now, but the meeting was good. It was something that I wanted to check his record, his experience that he had, his impartiality, talk to him about health care and precedent, judicial independence, and so it was a very solid visit.
Well, Senator Donnelly, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of these important issues. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon, we hope.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
I know. There are some major changes coming in Lake County politics involving the size of precincts in Lake County as a result of action by the General Assembly and is also by the Indiana Secretary of State's office. Secretary of State Connie Lawson had her staff work up a precinct consolidation plan for Lake County. That plan is to go into effect in 2019. Are we likely to see some kind of effect of similar plans elsewhere in the Hoosier State? Well, let's check in with Andy Downs, who is with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, to find out more. And as always, Andy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, if what you're aware of here on the changes, we know it's because that lawmakers decided that there had to be larger precincts in Lake County. And the big impact in trimming this, so the fact that there are only precincts no less than 600 active voters, is going to make some big impact on North Lake County in particular, and probably the Democratic Party.
It probably will. And actually, there are counties across the state that have done this on a regular basis. They look at precincts that are maybe shrinking in size and add them to another so that they get a larger precinct, more registered voters in it, more active voters in it. But the other also occurs. In other words, where there is growth, they sometimes have to cut things in half because precincts have gotten too big. And this legislation, House Bill 1383 from last year, for those who want to go look it up, specifically says that in Lake County, you got to have at least 600 active voters in a precinct. And the Secretary of State, the Chief Elections Officer, was told she had to go do this. If you think about Lake County, this becomes sort of pretty obvious what's going to end up happening. Where you see populations declining, you, of course, will see reductions in the number of registered voters. Therefore, precincts of size that would be considered too small, those will have to get consolidated. And the question is, can you consolidate them and still find good polling locations for the people left in those precincts?
Now, I know, according to the information from the report that the Secretary of State has turned over to the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration, that they managed to pare down precincts in three major communities in particular are really going to be affected by this. Gary, Hammond, and East Chicago. Does it seem that perhaps those are the communities that will be the losers with this change?
We have to ask ourselves what we mean by losers. And obviously, one issue here is how close is your polling location? The further you have to travel, the more difficult we make it to vote, the less likely some people are to vote. So obviously, in the communities where that's happened, that's clearly the sort of thing that people would say makes those communities losers. And where we see growth, sort of in the southern part of Lake County, or where fewer precincts got moved around, people get to have the same polling location they've had for a long time, and everything works out okay. Really, in the end, although where people vote is an obstacle, what matters is how campaigns and how political parties go about helping their voters get to the polls. And we've seen this, for example, with the increase in early voting that we've had for the last several years now, more and more campaigns being very wise about, you know, renting a bus or a van and picking up lots of people and taking them to go vote on the Saturdays before the election or days before the election as well. So it will require a change in strategy. Certainly for a lot of voters, though, their polling location is moving, and if they do not have transportation, this will end up being an issue for them.
I know that in particular in some of the areas that I'm going to be hardest hit because they have lost the most number of precincts, communities like Hammond and Gary in particular, the precinct organization is probably going to have to do a lot of trekking of people from wherever they happen to live to the closest polling place if that happens to be a lot further than where their old precinct used to be.
Exactly, and we know already, for example, there's discussion of polling locations moving as much as multiple miles, you know, 5-6 miles. That's clearly not the sort of thing someone who doesn't have a car is going to walk to any longer. That's quite the walk. And then it becomes the job of the parties, of the precinct organization, of the campaigns to try and move voters. Now, there theoretically could be another step to this, and that is the suggestion that Lake County go to vote centers. Now, vote centers are controversial because it certainly moves polling locations even further from where they are right now, but it also makes it easier for precinct-level organizations or campaigns to pick people up and take them to a single voting location. In other words, they don't have to worry that you need to go to precinct A and I need to go to precinct B in order to vote. Mm-hmm. They just pick us both up. We live across the street from each other, pick us both up, take us to one polling location, and that simplifies things. So I think that we can expect to hear an awful lot about polling place access and how that can be made easier, part of that through more early voting, possibly through vote centers as well.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who's with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, about the implications of with the changes that we're going to see here in Lake County with the precinct consolidation, fewer precincts, maybe further apart than what they used to be, and whether that's going to mean a difficult time for politicians to get elected or reelected, I suppose, whenever the next election is coming up. The consolidation doesn't officially take effect until January 1st, so we're talking about whatever elections come in 2017 and beyond, and I know for sure that this is going to have a big impact on the city elections when they do come up, I would imagine.
Oh, no doubt about that. That's true for a couple of reasons. First of all, the precincts will be further apart, polling locations will be further apart, or fewer of them, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, it'll be the first time. So there will be confusion just because of that. I always encourage voters, no matter what year it is, no matter how much they think they know exactly where they're supposed to vote, they should go to IndianaVoters.com to make sure they're registered and to see where they're supposed to vote. Certainly beginning in 2019, they should do that because of the changes that will happen in 19.
Now, Andy, from your experience and what you know from some of the other counties in Indiana that have kind of gone through this before, maybe, as you say, on a more regular basis, because they probably review their precinct sizes more often than what they've done in, here in Lake County, but have there been as many problems as what we're anticipating here in Lake County?
You know, it's typically been on a more piecemeal basis. There hasn't been sort of the massive wholesale changes. In Allen County, for example, we have done this, and the number of voters impacted has usually been smaller, and the change in location has not been as severe as we've heard some of these changes are likely to be in Lake County in 2019. So part of it is that so much of the work has just happened in this one chunk as opposed to little by little working in that direction. And it's significant. I mean, when you think about how easily you can go vote now, knowing that it will be even an extra mile of travel or 2 miles or more, that certainly does change the way you approach going to vote, especially if you're somebody who doesn't happen to have a car handy.
Well, I suppose we here in Lake County probably have maybe dreaded this, that what's finally happened, that we've seen the population migration from many neighborhoods in North Lake County down into the open areas of South Lake County over the years, and as people move down that way, and not only that, but the political party boundaries move too. We find that there are more Republicans now living in South Lake County than before. It seems like all the Democrats are nestled up in North Lake County. We'll see some impact there. We'll just have to wait and see what kind of impact that, I guess, that'll have on the elections when they do come up again.
As far as the Democrats are concerned, what they need to be thinking about is how do they move the voters around? How do they get them to the polling locations?
Yep.
And they do that through absentee voting, obviously, and maybe a more rigorous absentee ballot campaign. Certainly early voting is another way to do it. And then it may take a few more vehicles, but getting people to the polls on election day. So it's a strategy question. It's an implementation question that they fortunately have a year to be thinking about.
More interesting things to watch in politics here in Lake County going into 2019, to be sure. Andy, thanks very much for being with us to talk about it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Downs is with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's the host of Green Fleet Radio, Carl Lissick.
Thank you for joining us for another exciting edition of Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Ty Warner. He's the Executive Director for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Ty, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Great to be here. And I got to say again, just thank you again. It's a great partnership with South Shore Clean Cities. So happy to be here.
And we're always glad to have you here. And it's always exciting because there's so much great things that NERPC is working on right now. So, Ty, why don't you remind our listeners, what is NERPC?
Sure. Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. It is both a regional council of governments for Northwest Indiana, covering Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. It also is the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is a federal designation having to do with the distribution of federal transportation funds.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some significant technology developments happening that could impact transportation in our region, Ty?
Well, we're thinking about this a lot because, as you know, we're in the middle of our update of our long-range transportation plan,
mm-hmm.
Which we're looking out to the horizon year of 2050. So we have to be thinking about all these technological changes
Absolutely.
That are happening. Most people have a real hard time thinking beyond 5 years. It's really difficult to think way out. So you got to think, what are the things that are happening that are going to make significant impacts on our region so that we can try to get ahead of the game? I think some of the ones that come most to mind that is happening much faster than I think people expected is the whole autonomous vehicle situation. And it's not just autonomous vehicle, it's connected vehicle. And we can talk about that more in a minute. But that is just happening, I think, much faster than anybody really expected. What
Sure.
seemed to be sort of science fiction a while ago is now getting to the point where it's becoming reality very, very quickly.
And it's very exciting. So what do you think the effect of the autonomous vehicles will be on traffic congestion here in the future?
Yeah, there's two schools of thought mm-hmm. with that, and it really kind of depends on how things play out. One is that because of the efficiencies involved, solved, traffic congestion will get a lot better because everything is connected, signalized, timed, et cetera. We'll clear off the roadways more quickly. The other school of thought is because all these autonomous vehicles could eventually be essentially floating around waiting to pick up passengers,
sure.
that it could actually make congestion a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on how things develop with that technology and how we respond to it.
So what about land use with autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, so as everybody knows, Uber and Lyft and shared services like that are having a huge, huge impact, as is Amazon and online ordering and delivery. So many have said that what we're really entering into in terms of land use is essentially the new age of the curb. Drop-offs and pickups become much more important than parking a vehicle or whatever. So for autonomous vehicles in particular, you have to create that space to be able to pick up passengers, drop off passengers, et cetera. So that has a huge impact. The other big thing that could develop with that is if you think of all the amount of surface area devoted to parking in our cities,
absolutely.
Between parking garages and just flat surface parking lots, essentially everything changes with the dynamic of what you have to do with parking if autonomous vehicles are really the order of the day.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be in the center city. They can go out to the periphery of the city to park or await the next passenger or whatever. So if you think of all those parking garages, all that surface parking lots, all that asphalt, that could be converted to new land uses and be redeveloped.
Oh,
so massive changes.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
You're listening to Green Fleet Radio with Mr. Ty Warner, Executive Director for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. So what are some of the other ways autonomous vehicles could impact our future infrastructure needs?
Yeah, well, we're doing a lot already with what we call intelligent transportation systems that have to do with timing of signalization and that sort of thing. But if you magnify that for autonomous vehicles and other technologies, again, huge changes going on for both short-term and long-term. Short-term, if you think about the camera recognition technology and what that does for our signage, for things that vehicles recognize, I was at a presentation where certain company that everybody knows of for certain products of adhesives and things was really into this autonomous vehicle space, and it's because they're developing the paint that is more highly reflective of be able to be detected by autonomous vehicles. So they're in this space. So those kind of things, short term. Longer term, we're talking about, and this is where you get into connected vehicles, not just autonomous in the sense of an individual vehicle, but how does it communicate with its surroundings? How does it communicate with the traffic lights? How does it communicate with the vehicle that's coming around the corner that you can't even see?
Sure.
So all that infrastructure to be outfitted with that kind of connectivity is definitely on the horizon. In fact, Nevada is already doing something with this. Colorado is doing something with this for a whole digital highway initiative that they have. Again, it's a safety issue, really.
It is, absolutely.
Because you're not dependent on the driver to try to see where the accident's about to happen. The vehicle that's already communicating with the vehicles around it knows when there's an impending possible collision and can adapt.
Yeah, very, very exciting. So I know recently you and several other leaders from Northwestern Indiana went to Las Vegas, and you met about the Hyperloop. Tell our listeners about that.
Right. That was to go out to the Mojave Desert, which is the test facility for one of the primary Hyperloop companies that has chosen the corridor between Chicago and Columbus, Ohio, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as one of 10 in a global competition to study for this Hyperloop concept. And for those listeners that may not have heard about the concept before, just in a quick nutshell, if you think of that whole pneumatic tube, or when you put something through the bank, goes up to the tube and then goes to the teller. If you imagine how fast that thing is moving through that tube to the teller behind the window when you're in your car and sticking it in that tube, imagine that horizontal, stretched entirely across the country, but large enough to handle passengers. So if you remove all the air out of the tube so that you have no friction of air, and then you use maglev technology so that there's no friction on the wheels, you can get speeds around 700 miles per hour to shoot across vast amount of the country. So this corridor from Chicago to Pittsburgh basically becomes a 45-minute trip in theory. And so just like with autonomous vehicles, where you think that's just science fiction, what's happening so rapidly is, and this is what the sort of aha moment going out to this test facility is, how much money is being poured into this research. And another example of something that's happening much faster than I think we we maybe would have expected. Time will tell how this develops, but it's just something to keep on the...
Very exciting.
Exactly.
And so how can our listeners learn more about what's going on with NERPC and your 2050 plan?
Sure. So again, lots of people have ideas about what the future looks like and where we're headed. And so we'd love to hear those thoughts about what they envision for the future and what they see on the horizon. The best way to stay in touch with all this is through NERPC's website, which is nerpc.org, N-I-R-P-C.org. And we'll continually keep that updated with information about the 2050 plan development. Depending on when your listeners are listening to this broadcast, we have a series of pop-ups, which is basically going out to where people are at major events to be able to get their input at those events. And we're going to continue with that format. So throughout the rest of the development of the 2050 plan, we'll be doing that to receive input.
Exciting times, Ty Warner. Again, you know, keep up the great work. We look forward to hearing more from you and your staff. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Ty Warner, Executive Director for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And if you missed this episode of Green Fleet Radio, you can catch all the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as our opportunity to catch them on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. When Dean Foods decided to end procurement contracts with 27 of its 28 Hoosier farmers, dairy experts were concerned about the ramifications. Some farmers were lucky enough to find new markets for their milk. Others were not. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brock Turner reports, farmers were initially confident that they could find some new markets, but that seems to have changed.
John Claycamp says dairy farming is in his blood. He's been the owner of Lot Hill Dairy Farm in Jackson County for nearly 30 years. With his wife by his side, he's raised four kids and hundreds of cattle.
Now those cows, you know, they get breakfast first, and they get dinner first, and that's just the way it is.
Claycamp grew up on the farm. He and his father still work 7 days a week to ensure the cows are happy and healthy. He says there is nothing else he'd rather be doing.
Right or wrong, they always come first. You know, cows are out, cows having calves, cows need milk, and they need fed. That's just the way it is, and you do tend to put that before everything else.
This pasture in rural Jackson County was once home to more than 100 dairy cows. Now, Claycamp milks less than 40. The rising costs of feed and supplies paired with a decreased demand for milk has caused farmers like John across Indiana and the nation to cut the number of cows they milk. In 1975, the average American drank 8.5 ounces of liquid milk every day. Today, Americans drink about 5 ounces. Indiana Dairy Producers Executive Director Doug Lehman says farmers across Indiana will continue to be forced to make difficult decisions about their futures.
You know, we got to be real about it.
Lehman was a dairy farmer for nearly 40 years. He raised his family on the farm. But in 2011, Lehman quit milking cows because the margins were too slim to support his family. He says it was the hardest decision of his life.
Life does go on after milking cows. I can attest to that myself, so... there is life after milking cows. I want people to understand that, too. We're not wanting anybody to have to get out, but some may have to make those tough decisions.
2 out of every 3 Indiana dairy farms have closed up shop since 1997. That year, there were nearly 3,000 dairy farms in Indiana. Today, there are less than 1,000, and the situation continues to get worse.
We're all helpless at this time. There's not really anything I can personally do to come out and affect them getting a market. We can help with the communications, and that's what I'm trying to do. But, you know, we cannot force somebody to take them on as a customer.
It is unclear exactly why Dean Foods pulled contracts from nearly all Hoosier farmers. The company declined to comment for this story, but in a statement wrote increased competition and the introduction of new plants at a time when there is an industry-wide surplus of fluid milk, processing capacity forced us into this position. During what Dean Foods called a period of overproduction, the state recently celebrated the opening of another plant. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb says the plant is a win for everyone involved.
The area farmers and all the folks that we're going to be able to supply and stock, including 5 states, but at the end of the day, this is a huge win for consumers.
This new Walmart facility in Fort Wayne is one of the largest in the country. Some former Dean Foods producers got contracts from Walmart, but not all of them. It's estimated that 6 producers in Indiana haven't found a new market. Claycamp is among them. He admits the easiest thing to do would be to sell his dairy farm. but he doesn't want to leave the industry he's dedicated his life to without putting up a fight. That's why every Saturday, he attends a local farmer's market in Seymour.
How can I help you? I am sold out. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
He loads up his trailer and brings coolers filled with gelato, milk, and cheese.
The only thing I have left is Pepper Jack. I'm not Walmart. I don't need to make millions of dollars a year. I just want to make the farm payment, you know, and that's it.
Isn't that wonderful? Here's a spoon.
In the meantime, Clay Camp will savor every moment he gets with his cows out on the pasture, and he'll keep fine-tuning his recipes. Folks debate whether his chocolate milk has too much chocolate or not enough. For now, he's going to stick with his current recipe. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
Thank you. Hey, you come back and tell me how that was, okay? All right. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Last time we talked with this fellow was about the Gary Services Building project in Gary, and it was a project involving the Calumet Artist Residency. Let's turn now to Sam Love, who's the president of the Calumet Artist Residency, about a couple other new projects that are underway. Sam, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, it's great to talk with you again, Chris. Appreciate it.
Let's start out first about the new hashtag campaign that is underway, hashtag PublicArt219, and this, project involves a 40-foot-long, 10-foot-tall poetry wall entitled Gary Is. Tell us the thinking behind putting up this poetry wall in Gary.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the hashtag campaign first, actually,
okay.
Which is meant to draw attention to public art in Northwest Indiana, as well as sparking a dialogue about public art here. And that was devised by the Legacy Foundation. Our friends down in Merrillville there, and they asked a few of us artists who work out in the public sphere what we thought, and instantly we went and tagged all of our work on social media with the hashtag, and conversations began, and lo and behold, lots of public art is starting to appear around Gary and Northwest Indiana as well. Just Gary, for instance, might be getting upwards of 60 murals in the downtown area this summer and fall.
Wow.
So our contribution, our humble contribution, yes, is a 40-foot-long, 10-foot-tall green wall with a poem cut into it entitled Gary Is. And it is composed of lines that we collected during the Gary Poetry Project last year. We collected 1,100 lines of poetry from the 67 events and workshops that we held in Gary last year. And all of these lines have the words Gary Is in there. So we pulled those ones out, weave them together, and we're really pleased with the results that came out. We're proud to have that out in public. It's along Miller Avenue, about a block west of the 18th Street Brew Pub.
Wow.
So it shows the good and the bad. It shows the exceptional and the ordinary. And what we hope is that the poem, and especially putting it out there in public, sends a message that it's really hard to tell a single story about this city, no matter what's happening out here. There's a lot of life out here, and that's what sustains us. So it's a beautiful poem, and we're still basking in the glow of the poetry project, but we're doing the nature project this year, so we're still keeping up with a lot of poetry, but now we're getting outdoors even more.
Well, and we'll talk more about the Gary Nature Project in just a moment here, but you mentioned here about the fact that the Gary Poetry Project is still alive with this particular project of the poetry wall on Miller Avenue. I guess there's some other things there on the property, too, and I guess you have to make arrangements if you do want to see it because it is private property.
Yes, and that particular road is narrow, it curves, and it's dangerous, and people drive too fast, and a lot of pedestrians, especially people who live in Etna in the Glen Ryan neighborhood, walk through there to get to Lake Street to do their shopping and whatnot. So there's nowhere to park. I mean, people are welcome to view it, but we would ask if people want to really spend some time out there with it that they would make arrangements with us, and they can email info@calumetresidency.com. And we're out in the community just about every day that it's nice. So it's really no problem to have people come over. We're just concerned more about the safety of it. And gradually over the years, we're going to evolve this property into something that the public can use. In fact, we're going to try to engineer a path so that pedestrians can actually step a bit off this road. It's at a curve. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
So Functional. As well as beautiful.
I've been out in that area. Yeah, it's fun drive in that area. But yeah, it's pretty treacherous right there. It's a good place to see something, but you can't really slow down very much to see it. So you'd be better off to be able to park someplace and actually get to walk over to it. Yeah. Now, let's take a moment here and give credit to the folks that helped you out with the Gary Poetry Project. You mentioned about the Legacy Foundation of Northwest Indiana, which is, of course, Lake County's own community foundation. They had some outside help, I understand, in getting this project going, too. Tell us about that.
Oh, are you asking about the Knight Foundation?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That's the main sponsor of the Poetry Project and both the Nature Project. It's called the Knight Donor Advisory Fund, and we applied for the Poetry Project and received the grant, and then they asked us to apply again. So we came up with the Nature Project. And this, Legacy, how this operates is they have three pillars that are at the core of their mission, and they'd like you to align. They want to, how does your project align with one or all of these pillars? So the one that we chose specifically was the civic pillar. And with what's happening in Gary this year with the comprehensive master planning that's going on, we're using the Nature Project as a way to generate awareness about the natural treasures the city of Gary has, because it's quite a few. The city never fully developed, and that left a lot of rare ecosystems, dune and swales, savannas, wetlands, and whatnot. And people, as history shows us, people fight like hell here and throughout Northwest Indiana to protect that. So we want to highlight Gary's role in those struggles to conserve the environment, and it's still going on today. The kids down at Steel City Academy are doing a great job with that. But also things like taking kids who've never been to the lakeshore in Gary and making sure that through their youth group or their summer program that they and their friends get a chance to have that experience. And we brought the summer youth group from the Gary Historical and Cultural Society to Marquette Park. We had a wonderful intergenerational group, probably from 5 up to, I don't want to date anybody, but, a lot of wisdom there, and it was wonderful.
That's great.
Absolutely wonderful.
We
are very, very grateful to Knight and Legacy for seeing the value in this. And then we tie it back to that civic pillar by getting people to talk and discuss, reflect upon their environment and what they'd like to see happen. And then that information is going to get communicated directly to the city, to the redevelopment department, to the planning department, to the mayor, to the city council, and everybody. It's a completely public process, and we'll have news about meetings in the city coming up. So.
Now, you mentioned about the track to the lakefront by the youngsters involved in the Gary Historical and Cultural Society. When they went out to Marquette Park, did they do some interesting things out there? Did they just check the lakefront out? Did they go to like the Douglas Center or places out there within the area to enjoy not only the flora and the fauna, but just the nice day out there?
It was beautiful. They got right to work at playing. I mean, it is such a wonderful thing to see youth without anything but their imaginations, their bodies, and the environment just set about organizing themselves and playing. I mean, we were out there for 4 hours. There was no fighting. There was just smiles the whole time. I mean, we had little kids and teenagers, right? Teenagers are supposed to be sullen and too cool, but they just occupied themselves, and I was able to relax and enjoy myself because, of course, we adults are responsible for their safety. And we taught them that the lake is a dangerous and powerful yet beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And then, yes, we did get to take them to the Douglas Center. In fact, they demanded to go to the Douglas Center.
Oh, really?
So we had to oblige.
Wow.
Yeah, I every time I volunteer or work with young people in nature out here, they, what is this lupin flower and this Carter butterfly? You must take us to see these things. So that's why we did this project. The demand is there. The knowledge is there. We didn't get taught this in schools. We did not get taught that Gary was where the science of ecology was born here. And rather than be bitter about that, we're going to do our part to expose everybody to the wonders that are here and help interpret it and help them connect with it.
Now,
we've had many partners this year, Field Museum, Nature Conservancy. The list goes on and on.
Now, Sam, see, that shows that, as grown-ups, you remember these things, and you know that your responsibility is to direct the young people that come after us into taking advantage of these opportunities, because that's the only way that they ever survive and ever continue on when they grow up. And hopefully they'll be able to follow your steps and take groups out to Marquette Park, to the Douglas Center, and then have a chance to take advantage of these youth programs too. Now, you mentioned about the Gary Nature Project being involved in this one particular nature education project with the Gary Parks Department, with their summer program. Is there anything else that you have in mind or that you're working with the Parks Department on here for the rest of the summer?
It's developing, I suppose, and I think that there's going to be a lot of good energy and organization coming out. Nate George, the superintendent, actually was one of the first people I met when I started as a community organizer here, mm-hmm. and he was as well. So that relationship and, you know, that trust is already in place. There's also opportunities through federal programs to get a lot more funding. And just the short of it is, if we do a great job this summer and can document, you know, what we did with this summer youth program, there's opportunities to get even more funding to continue this on year round. So continued engagement through the public parks, definitely, I think, in the best interest of everybody. And we're lucky, you know, mayor is aware of these things and she is actively encouraging that. So it's good that we don't have to fight, the elected officials on that front. You know, we're on the same side on this one, so we can get more done.
Sam Love, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about these projects in particular, and we hope to have you back on again and talk in a little bit more detail, especially if you have more great summer projects involving the young people of the city of Gary.
Will do. I always appreciate it.
Sam Love is the president of the Calumet Artist Residency. Those wet wipes that you use in the restroom or the bathroom at home may not be flushable after all. They're clogging up sewers, and they're sending a lot of taxpayer dollars down the drain. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal tells us, experts are arguing these days over which projects are to blame.
Open up a sewer lift in the city of Warsaw, and you'll find a lot of things. Cigarettes, gum, and many, many wet wipes. Warsaw Wastewater Utility Manager Brian Davison says those wipes aren't breaking down like they should.
Some will clog the pumps, which then cause a sewer backup upstream from that pumping station. So potentially we could have sewer backup into basements, run out onto the ground. It can cause problems.
What's more, it's making another problem in Indiana's sewers worse. Warsaw Assistant Utility Manager Larry Hyden says the wipes bind to fats, oils, and grease, which are notorious for their stink. He says he's nearly lost his lunch before.
Probably the worst smell I've been involved in, yes.
Davison says cleaning out these wipes gets expensive, and that cost gets passed on to the residents of Warsaw. He says every time his team gets a call to fix a backup in the middle of the night, it could cost as much as $2,000 in overtime and equipment. But this isn't just happening here, or even in Indiana. Cities all over the country are experiencing these clogs, and some are crafting laws to prevent them. New York City and Washington, D.C. are trying to pass legislation that would change the requirements for wipes to be marketed as flushable. When wastewater workers get together, wipes are a topic of conversation. At this year's Indiana Water Environment Association Challenge in Shelbyville, industry professionals came from all over the state to compete in safety relays.
Position the expanding tool as shown below. You can't abandon until locking is passed.
Gary Merriman was there. He helps repair the city of Fort Wayne's sewer system, which has also had issues with wipes.
If I could, I'd drop it in the front door. That'd kind of let them know really what they shouldn't do, but so far they frown on that.
According to the Association of the Nonwoven Fabrics Industry, only 7% of disposable wipes are marketed as flushable. The problem is, it's hard to tell. Wet wipe companies don't make it that obvious on the packaging.
These are Pampers, and underneath this flap is where it says, do not flush.
That's Bradley Fix, superintendent at Shelbyville Water Resource Recovery Facility. He's also a part of the water quality nonprofit, the Water Environment Federation, or WEF. Fix says WEF has been working with the wipes industry to make bigger logos where customers can see them. Unfortunately, that's about the only thing that industry and wastewater officials can agree on. They have different ideas about what should be considered flushable and how to test products to make sure they dissolve. The wipes industry argues that flushable wipes do break down. It's other disposable wipes that are to blame, like baby wipes. President of the Association of the Nonwoven Fabrics Industry, Dave Roos, points to a 2016 study where objects were sorted in a New York City wastewater facility. We reached him through Skype.
The largest constituent was paper towels in most of the studies. Paper towels, not designed nor marketed to be flushed.
However, the New York Department of Environmental Protection has refuted this study and says it's not representative of what the agency's seen in New York sewers. But even if the study's findings are accurate, wastewater experts say flushable wipes have started a bad trend. Brianne Nakamura of the Water Environment Federation talked to us through Skype.
They were kind of that first category of wipes that were saying, hey, you can flush this, it's allowed, put it down your toilet, it's not a big deal. And they really kind of changed the consumer's perspective of what can go down the toilet.
Back in Warsaw, Larry Hayden says people need to know that simply flushing a wet wipe can cause expensive problems in their communities.
Even though it says flushable on it, doesn't always mean that you should just flush it down the drain, because out of sight's not out of mind for us anyhow.
Hayden says he'll certainly never flush a wet wipe again. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Rise Northwest Indiana is a nonpartisan organization that works to empower local citizens to be strong advocates for the quality of life here in Northwest Indiana. Two members of the group, Sarah Ferraro and local high school student Gabriella Hay, came on Regionally Speaking recently to talk about Rise Northwest Indiana.
A lot of people asking questions of us because we had done a lot of things politically in Lake County, and they're like, how can I get engaged? What can I do? What can I, you know, how can I learn about this? How can I, all these different questions. So we decided to build a training hub of resources for people to kind of learn about not only political offices, but how they can get involved, what they can do in their community to make a difference. And we started under a different name. And since being funded by the Legacy and Knight Foundations, now we're called Rise Northwest Indiana. So it's been a whirlwind of events and people and trainings that have had 65 to 70 people at them. And
wow.
So, it's a lot of...
It's a lot of people to be involved in that.
A lot of energy. So, we've done trainings on running for office for things... as low as school board to all the way up to state representative. So, and now we're just looking at people getting engaged here in their community to what they can do locally at festivals, fairs, parades, anything, you name it. I invited Gabriella Hay she was going to kind of observe, but I know she can tell us a little bit about what she's been doing locally. She's a young student leader who's been participating in our activities. And
so I've actually written a letter to the editor before, and tonight I'm helping Rise out. They're holding a workshop to help people write letters to the editor, which is a good way of getting your voice out, letting people know what you think. So since I've written one before, and I'm younger, we're going to have some people, I guess, learn from me. And then kind of one of our main goals is to kind of say, like, hey, I'm 17 and I wrote one, and you guys should be able to, too. So, I'm just hoping to help them out, teach some people some new things. I'm really excited.
Was there anything in your experiences at Lake Central High School that got you interested, or at least to more closely examine this and led to your participation in Rise Northwest Indiana?
I guess the main thing is we don't really have very many opportunities for civic engagement at the high school. So actually this year I started a civics club, and this will be our first year running, actually doing activities. So the fact that we didn't have very many opportunities to practice our civic engagement is one of the reasons that I obviously would need to go outside of the school to do it. And I'm I don't enjoy that we don't have that many opportunities, so I kind of had to make them for myself.
Well, that's how these things get started, I suppose, this way, too. And you probably have taken great advantage of the opportunities of the training and all the sessions that you've been able to attend through Rise Northwest Indiana. It probably helps fill some of the gaps in your education on civics, hasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely has. Just seeing all the different ways people can contribute, because not everyone likes doing the same thing. You know, sometimes people are knocking doors trying to register people to vote, but not everyone likes that. So that's why it's good we have the letter to the editor workshop and things like that.
The group has affiliations or partnerships, I guess would be a better way to put it, with other organizations here in Northwest Indiana that you have helped to not only enhance but also probably augment some of the educational efforts. Tell us about how these other groups, who the other groups are and how they fit in.
So we, this past spring, built relationships and partnerships with IU Northwest, Purdue Northwest, and they're fully engaged and on board with our content and ready to do more in the fall. We kind of came at a time when the students were getting ready for, you know, to leave for the summer. So this coming fall, we're going to fully engage with them and do some things there. I'm excited about that. Also, the United Way has helped us to amplify our volunteer opportunities through things that they, resources that they have, and we're looking forward to working with them in the future. But I would say the most exciting one, and I know Chris has probably spoken with members of the League of Women Voters before, so
oh, yes.
The local chapter here mm-hmm. in Lake County, the Calumet area, I'm also on the executive board, but they're just looking for more ways to amplify their group and how can their group grow, and this was a perfect partnership. So RISE is actually fully aligned with because we are nonpartisan. We're part of a 501c3 through the Legacy Foundation, and that's the same alignment that the league has. So we're building a website that's going to host not only who's on your ballot, but hopefully some candidate surveys so we can learn more about candidates. And that's what the league does, kind of, you know, get to know who's on your ballot. And I know they'll have debates coming up this fall, so we're hoping to help them amplify things on social media and really get that out there. They're very excited about this partnership.
Do you think that being a nonpartisan organization, as opposed to being a Republican or a Democrat organization, helps or maybe even makes things more difficult to try to get the word out, to try to educate people about the importance of being civically engaged?
I'm just so passionate about what we're doing for RISE and here in Lake County and especially all of Northwest Indiana. But I would say, that's been an interesting question for us is, you know, this is a difficult arena for people to understand the whole nonpartisan kind of genre that we're working in. But I feel it's a positive aspect because we can do so many more things in the community that and expose people to not only voter registration, but, you know, the League of Women Voters, amplifying them. So it's been difficult for the leadership of RISE to explain about how that works. But at the same time, it's helped people to know that we can all come together and all have these conversations and we can all learn together and grow together here in Lake County.
RISE Northwest Indiana is funded through a partnership with the Legacy Foundation of Lake County and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie is joining us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his woman-human, Victoria Voller. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, congratulations to Italian performer Luciano Azzastini, a Big Apple circus clown who has patiently trained 10 shelter dogs to be part of his new circus show. I learned of him when my owner Googled rescue dogs that perform. I'm not the kind of dog that lies around daydreaming all day long or watching television. I'm looking for some challenges, like joining the circus. For instance, what about doing police work or helping to rescue humans? I could even sniff out bad things at the airport. Competitions look like a lot of fun. I've been told I'm a fast runner and I'm quite agile. Even trying out in a dog show, going out on the road and meeting all sorts of dogs and humans would be so exciting. And I have learned about therapy dogs that help humans when things aren't going great. Being an Australian Shepherd, I have herding skills that come naturally for me. So I practiced on our neighbor while she was trying to drive her car out of the driveway. Every time she got out of the car, I stepped to the side and tried to herd or escort her onto the front porch of the house. She wasn't very happy with my efforts, so I had to stop. It's hard to herd in a subdivision. I mean, if not my neighbor, then who? I know you'll suggest that I should herd cats. That, Ollie, is ridiculous. Not even a herding dog can herd cats. Or so I've heard. I need to do something. Maybe police work or therapy work or working with the blind. With all of these choices, I don't know where to start. What does a dog need to do to get trained for these things? Can any dog do anything? Signed, Romper, an Aussie on the move. Well, Victoria, I've had several dogs in my life. I now have a cat, and I can honestly say that none of them could handle any of those types of duties.
Right, or herd that cat.
That's right.
Dear Romper, these are excellent questions that you thought of all by yourself. It's true that certain dogs are better suited for specific activities than others, and that's a fact. I, for one, can't herd. I've tried that gig, and no one follows me. Since I'm excellent at sitting in laps and looking adorable, I have helped in some local training with reading programs and children. You are right. Not all dogs are good at all things. Guide dogs for the blind are identified after just 6 months of training. Some dogs can't cut that program, so they get picked up for other work. One dog that I read about ended up as a surfer dog doing shows at a California beach. My suggestion for you is to start your career by enrolling in an agility training class. Running those courses of jumps, tunnels, teeter-totters, tables, etc. with your human is an excellent practice for the human-dog relationship. Agility training is a great way to get rid of your excess energy, challenge your mind and body, strengthen your muscles, improve coordination, and increase your endurance. Hey, it will also help your human with exercising because at the finish of a course, that human will be treated to a heart-healthy cardiovascular workout. We're lucky because in Northwest Indiana, there are several regional places to find out more about agility training, and they include Paws Power Blues Dog Club in Cedar Lake, Canine Connect Dog Sports in Valparaiso, and Canine Country Club in Valparaiso. The humans who run these schools know other stuff about dog careers, too, so you can get some good information. I was in agility training once, and I learned a lot. But I'm still more skilled at just sitting on laps and being a darling dog. Good luck. I hope you find your niche. Love, Ollie, your friend in fur. And remember, love is a four-legged word.
And if you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia, all one long word, .org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, which means we have reporters coming in to talk about the stories that they have been covering online and in print. And we will have from the Post-Tribune tomorrow, Meredith Colius-Pete and Carol Carlson. And from Inside Indiana Business in Indianapolis, Andy Ober will join us. And from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Doug Ross will be with us as well.